This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
A Toronto man was accused of running a human smuggling network and put behind bars for more than 2 years. Eventually, he was given bail, and when he showed up for his trial, he learned that his charges had quietly been stayed. I'm Dave Breckenridge, and this is 10-3. Freelance reporter Luke Rinaldi joins me to discuss how police turned their focus to this man, why he was locked up for so long before being let go, and how the criminal proceedings upended his life in Canada. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Amazon Music. I'd love it if you could leave us a rating, a review, and tell your friends about the show. So, Luke, you recently wrote a really fascinating feature for the National Post about a man named Daegun Chun. So before we get into some of the details about what happened to him, tell listeners, who is he? Who is Daegun Chun? Where's he from? What did he do for work? And even, how did you find out about this guy?
Yeah, Daegun Chun was, up until about 2015, he was a Korean Methodist pastor. He and his aunt ran a school in North Toronto, you know, a career college and private high school. He practiced Chinese holistic medicine. But of course, none of that was the reason I started paying attention to him. The reason I started paying attention to him was because he was arrested in 2015. And the RCMP accused him of being a criminal kingpin, that he was organizing a very sophisticated sex trafficking ring that was bringing women in from Korea and China and bringing them to Canada to work as prostitutes. And it was actually that particular word kingpin that was central to how I found him. I was sort of, you know, as a journalist does, searching around, looking at legal documents, and I literally searched the word kingpin, and that's what alerted me to the existence of his story and the fact that he was then fighting back.
That's a wild story. Like, just, I mean, finding it is one thing, but even just what you say happened to him or what police accused him of. Walk us through what happened to him on April 1st, 2015, and his arrest.
That morning, he was at home in North Toronto. He lived in an apartment there, and he was meeting with his aunt, who, as I mentioned, helped run the school. I believe she was the owner, and he was the marketing manager. And so they were chatting, and what he says happened was around 9 a.m. that morning, the RCMP busted into his apartment, brought him and his aunt to the ground, arrested them, and separated them, took Mr. Chun to a vehicle, drove him to the airport, put him on a helicopter. That helicopter went to an airport near Montreal. And that was the first time he says that he knew what was going on, because a press conference was held and an RCMP spokesperson before the media said that Mr. Chun was responsible for overseeing and operating a sophisticated sex trafficking ring. And that, as far as he knows, or as far as he's told me, was the first time that he heard that allegation.
So we have, he gets grabbed from his apartment in Toronto. He gets flown to Montreal and then kind of marched in front of the press, police saying he's kind of the ringleader of this human trafficking investigation. What is it the police allege that he was doing? How is he all tied up in this?
So it all starts with some wiretaps that the police had set up. They were looking at a number of suspects in Toronto and Montreal specifically, but also across Canada. And they had seen Daegun Chun's name come up in some correspondence with two suspects. These were two people living in apartments in Toronto, and they rented those apartments from Mr. Chun. So as part of his work at the school, Mr. Chun held, he leased a number of apartments that were intended for newcomer students in case, you know, they arrive in Canada and are having trouble finding housing. You know, so they can attend the school and rent an apartment from basically the school itself as well. And so Mr. Chun rented two apartments to these two people known by their English names as Jay and Renee. And Mr. Chun says, you know, he didn't give it much thought. These were just apartments that were up for rent. Students didn't need them. So he provided these apartments to these two people. What the police allege is that in those apartments, there was prostitution work happening. And they allege that it's not that Mr. Chun, you know, didn't know about these things. They say, in fact, he knew exactly what was happening in those apartments that he was renting. And they also allege that he was using the school as a bit of a cover for these young women being brought over. They were saying that he was helping arrange their immigration paperwork, helping them find the you know, places where they would do the sex work. And so they, you know, forwarded this theory that the school was essentially a front for this sex trafficking ring.
So authorities say Chun and this school is the hub of this human trafficking ring, that all done through the school, and he was a key piece of it. What did Chun have to say about this theory?
From the very beginning, Chun said, "I have no idea what you're talking about." He said, "I don't know about any prostitution. I do know Jay and Renee. I rent apartments to them. They pay rent to me. I think Jay works at a market. I think Renee's wealthy because she drives a Benz. But beyond that, I don't know much about these two people. And there must be some kind of misunderstanding. It may be that, you know, I was in correspondence with them and it was mistranslated, or there was, you know, some sort of suspicious transfer of money, but that was just rent. You know, that was them paying rent to me." And he said all these little pieces of evidence that the police are putting together to come up with the story that I, Mr. Chun, am a criminal mastermind, that theory is just bunk. You know, that's what he says. And from the very first time that I spoke to him, he maintained his innocence. And that was, you know, a good 9 years after the fact that I spoke to him, and he was still dealing with this situation.
After his arrest, you wrote that he said he felt like the police would realize at some point they got the wrong guy, they made a mistake here. Was there a point for him where that feeling started to fade? Like, how did he describe that period?
Yeah, I think at first he sort of held out hope, or at least he told me he held out hope that the police would realize, okay, their evidence isn't as robust as they thought it would be. The allegation that he's a kingpin is not right. And he thought they'll see that, they will give me bail, and we'll all figure this out. And I think the moment that it started to sink in that that was not going to happen for him was at his first bail hearing. And I think this was within a week or two of his arrest. He shows up at court in Quebec, and he is basically pleading, you know, conditional release. We'll figure this out, but at least I can sort of go back to my life. You know, with some conditions. And in fact, there were eight other people arrested as part of this whole operation called Project Confidence. And those eight other people all received bail, but Mr. Chun didn't. And that was, I think, the moment where he started to realize, okay, this is not going to be a quick and easy solution. It's not a simple misunderstanding. I don't think at that point he had a sense of what was coming, but he would end up staying in jail for nearly 3 years.
We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So his co-accused were released on bail, but he didn't at that time. Why was it that the Crown wanted to keep him behind bars?
So I've reviewed the documents from two bail hearings, the first one, and then he appealed for a second one. And in both of those cases, The judges simply say that a conviction is likely. So in the first bail hearing, the judge is simply saying that based on everything that they've seen so far, it looks like this theory of Chan being a kingpin is probably right. And the Crown, the prosecutors need more time to put together their case. And so, you know, to give the courts a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, you could say, well, yeah, the RCMP alleged this huge thing, and we don't want a kingpin out here on the streets, you know, roaming free and possibly getting back to their criminal work. But Mr. Chun then came back and he refuted something that the judge said, which was that Mr. Chun didn't have a home address or a cell phone linked to his home address or a driver's license linked to a home address. These were all used as evidence in the first bail hearing that he was, quote unquote, a ghost in Canada, which is how the judge described it. So in his appeal, Mr. Chun came forward with a bunch of sort of identifying documentation, you know, material about the school that he ran, basically proof that he was a normal guy who was registered in normal ways and sort of not operating in the shadows as the Crown alleged. And in the second bail hearing, the judge did agree, you know, this guy is not a ghost. He's not trying to hide. He's out here in the open. He's registered as normal. But that second judge still agreed, it looks like there's enough evidence to convict, and the Crown needs more time to build its case. And so the judge decided, I'm going to allow the Crown that time. And in the meantime, you know, we're basically going to assume that Mr. Chun could be this kingpin, and so we don't want to let him out. And that was the case sort of over and over again. He was denied bail, and then, you know, things sort of kept going, and he would come back to court, and it would just keep dragging on and on and on.
Was he ever offered a deal? And if he was, why did he not take the deal?
Yeah, so Mr. Chun told me about these two incidents that happened about, you know, a year or two into his custody. And what he told me happened was that the Crown came forward and said, hey, look, when we were searching Northern Lights, your school, we found these forged teaching certificates. And if you plead guilty to possession of these forged teacher certificates, we'll just let you go. We will, you know, forget about the other charges, and you can spend Christmas with your family, is what Mr. Chen's lawyer told him. And, you know, that'll be it, and we'll put it all behind us. And Mr. Chun was, you know, as he told me, not particularly excited about that idea. You know, if we assume that he's telling us the truth, essentially he's been wrongfully arrested and charged with things he didn't do. And now the Crown is suggesting he plead guilty to this entirely different thing. So he said, no, I mean, of course I would love to see my family. Of course I would like to get out of here, but I'm not going to plead guilty to this other random thing you just introduced. I want to deal with the matter at hand, which is this humongous accusation against me, which is that I'm a criminal kingpin. And so this happened once and he declined it, and he says that it happened again, and he again declined. And one thing I'll mention about these offers was that, you know, at first I didn't really have anything much more than Mr. Chun's word to go on when it came to whether these offers were really made, if they were made as he said they were. His lawyer at the time has since passed away. But as I was reviewing some RCMP documents, I did find that the Ministry of Colleges and Universities, or whatever it may have been called at that time, they had in fact been in touch with the RCMP and offered up evidence of forged teaching certificates and said, I don't know if this will be helpful for your investigation, but, you know, it's something we have. And so there seems to be something of a link. The timeline lines up that, you know, these documents were offered up to the RCMP. And it seems like, you know, if Chun is telling the truth, that's exactly what happened. They came to him and said, if you plead guilty to these, we'll let everything else go.
Chun's ordeal takes another weird twist when he shows up for his trial in March of 2018. What happened on that day?
Yeah, so by March of 2018, Mr. Chun had been out of jail for a few months. It was sort of a random day, I think, in late 2017, where he was simply given bail. He hadn't applied for it. It just sort of materialized, and he was let out of jail and allowed to go back home so long as he checked in weekly with the RCMP. And so he was preparing for his trial. He was getting ready for a date in March 2018, and he gathered up his cousin, his aunt, his lawyer, a translator, and they all made their way to Montreal for what they thought would be the beginning of a trial, or at least a court date. And they show up, and the way they tell it, Mr. Chun's name was not on the docket for the day. There was no trial scheduled. And so they went to the court office and asked, you know, what's going on? Like, we thought we had a trial today. And the way they tell it, the court said, no, that case was, the charges were stayed about 2 weeks ago. The chief prosecutor said, we have to stay these charges. And they say they weren't informed of that, that, you know, they expected the trial to go forward. And so all of a sudden, Mr. Chun is sort of free to go and is left in a bit of a limbo because stayed charges can be sort of resurrected within a year. So Mr. Chun had about a year to see if the charges would come back or if he would have these charges permanently stayed and essentially go back to the life that he knew. But that life was really not there anymore. The school had shut down and a lot of people basically assumed he was the criminal that the police said he was.
So that's March of 2018 when charges were stayed. And as you say, there's a year to kind of steel yourself for the possibility that you could be back in court. We're now 6 years later. It's 2024. Where has this ordeal left Chun? Has he been able to rebuild his life? Has he gotten to any semblance of where he was at before all this happened? And what does he have to say about the way that he was treated by the justice system?
It's been a long process for him. At first, especially during that first year of not knowing whether the charges would come back or not, I think that was a particularly difficult year, given, you know, he was still missing a lot of his possessions. They were confiscated and still considered part of the investigation. And it would take a long time for him to get a lot of those things back. In fact, I think he's still fighting to get certain things back. There were also problems with, you know, getting access to social services, getting access to employment insurance. You know, he couldn't work with this on sort of his record. And in the news, there were very few people who were sort of willing to give him a job, at least sort of in the realm that he was working in before with education and holistic medicine. And so he relied on his faith community. You know, he had a pastor who was a friend who, you know, served as a close friend and support. And he's been trying to rebuild his life. In fact, he is in the process of registering another school, something that would replace Northern Lights, his old school. He's been studying accounting. He's in fact in the process of getting a Canadian citizenship, although that has been a sort of long, drawn-out process. He inquired why it was taking so long, and he was told that he was having a security check done by the RCMP, which is the institution he is suing. So, you know, he's in a tricky spot, and he's now, you know, waiting to see what will happen with the action that he is taking now against the government and the RCMP.
Overall, is this something that's kind of made him question staying here? Is he looking to try and kind of stake out a new life in this country, or is he kind of soured on the Canadian experience?
It's a little bit of both. He's certainly soured. I don't think he ever thought that something like this would happen in Canada. And certainly, he told me many times, hearing from other people, they didn't think something like this would happen in Canada. But at the same time, you know, he is applying to be a resident. He hasn't left Canada in over 10 years. And that's partly because he thinks if he left, he probably would not be able to get back in. He would love to see his family in Korea, but he is just worried that if he does, he's essentially saying goodbye to Canada forever, unless he has a citizenship. So he's waiting until that happens. And, you know, there is a part of him that still says, this happened to me, and it does shake my, you know, belief in the justice system and the policing system, but he still believes Canada is a good place. It's his home, and he wants to stay here. He does have a community, and he wants to rebuild what he had. So he certainly hasn't given up on the country as a whole, but I do think that it's really colored his interpretation of the country where he now lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a fascinating story, a frightening ordeal. I can't imagine going through something like that. And thank you for your reporting, Luke. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dave.
10-3 is produced by Sean Knox. Theme music by Bryce Hall. Thanks to my guest, Luke Rinaldi. More from him at his website, lukerinaldi.com, or you can read his full feature at nationalpost.com. I'm Dave Breckenridge. Thanks for listening.